Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church holds its first worship service today since a white gunman killed 9 black people at Bible study group at the historic African-American church last week. Inside the South Carolina church, packed crowds sang songs of faith, filling the hall. Since the shootings on Wednesday, the church has been transformed into a memorial with people writing tributes and leaving flowers outside. At today's service, the church's leader called for love, peace, and praise.
This is the day. This is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice.
Both church and community were shocked by Wednesday's attack of 21-year-old Dylan Roof, a white man with a recent history of racist views. He is in the Charleston County Jail charged with 9 counts of murder. At least 3 militants died as al-Shabaab attacked an intelligence training facility today in Mogadishu. Abdulaziz Bilo reports.
Gunmen from the Al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab arrived outside the compound in an explosive-laden vehicle, detonating the car outside the intelligence training base in Shibis district. Police say the 2 gunmen apparently lost their way and were attacking a civilian house close to their target when they were shot and killed. National Security Ministry spokesman Mohammed Yusuf said the government had intelligence that helped in foiling the attack. He said that since the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, security personnel have been deployed on major roads of the capital. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News. Mogadishu.
And Afghanistan's parliament has voted to extend its own term beyond the constitutionally mandated 5 years supported by President Ashraf Ghani. This is VOA News. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon marked World Refugee Day this weekend with a global call to remember the plight of nearly 60 million people displaced by conflict and persecution in the past year. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres spoke.
Their numbers are growing and accelerating every single day on every continent. In 2014, an average of 42,500 people became refugees, asylum seekers, or internally displaced persons every single day. And that is 4 times more than just 4 years ago.
The United Nations says one out of every 122 humans is now either a refugee, internally displaced, or seeking asylum. If that were the population of a country, UNHCR reports it would be the world's 24th largest nation. The United States is calling on debt-ridden Greece to make some tough decisions leading to a quick deal with international creditors to prevent the potential breakup of the eurozone. The Greek government needs to reach a deal by June 30th to avoid default on a loan repayment of $1.8 billion to the International Monetary Fund. Athens also owes a payment of $7.6 billion to the European Central Bank. Greek Finance Minister Yanis Yafoukaras.
We are dangerously close to a state of mind that accepts an accident. And I urge my colleagues not to fall prey to this state of mind. We can forge a good agreement. Our government is standing by with ideas and with the determination to cultivate the 2 forms of trust necessary to end this Greek drama.
Negotiations remain at a standstill ahead of an emergency summit of European leaders set for tomorrow in Brussels. Mali's Tuareg-led rebels have signed a peace agreement with the Bamako government. The UN-brokered accord, signed by a representative of coalition rebel groups of the Azawad movement, calls for the election of regional assemblies in Mali, but stops short of granting autonomy to northern Mali. The peace accord is being hailed as a landmark achievement by those involved in the negotiations. However, political observers point out other peace plans in recent years failed to end the violence between the nation's bitterly divided ethnic and regional factions. South Korea reporting 3 new cases of Middle East respiratory syndrome today. That brings the number of ill to 170, also the death of another MERS patient, raising the death toll in that country to 25. A 6th mass extinction period on the Earth is underway, according to a new study from 3 leading U.S. universities, warning humans could be among the first affected. Results revealed that during the last century, when more than 400 vertebrates disappeared, that was a rate of extinction at least 114 times higher than normal. However, today in the United States, we celebrate Father's Day, an occasion marking and celebrating the contributions of all fathers. Happy Father's Day. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm in Peter Clote in Washington.
If you look at the key issues that have been raising, for instance, they talk about access to information bill. They have been complaining that the aspect that gives no room to someone who gets information.
The Tanzanian government comes under criticisms over new media laws.
I said, let me bring something for our Muslim to foster peace between us and them, for mutual understanding, so that they may break their fast this evening and pray for our nation.
Christian clerics in Nigeria distribute food to prisoners in the country's north to mark the beginning of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
If you look at the country today, everybody is crying. We have a giant water project that we are putting on. But immediately the light goes off, there is no water. These are things that are really creating problems.
And the Cameroonian economy suffers following recent electrical power outages, seen as the worst since the country's independence. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. White House said U.S. President Barack Obama will in late July become the first sitting American leader to visit Ethiopia and the headquarters of the African Union. Mr. Obama will meet both the Ethiopian government and AU leaders for talks aimed at accelerating economic growth, strengthening democratic institutions, and improved security. But Human Rights Watch says Obama should use his visit to highlight the Ethiopian government's poor human rights record. For more, Sarah Morgan, the director at Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C., joins us live via telephone link up. Good afternoon, Mr. Morgan. Ms. Morgan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, let me ask you this. You're welcome, by the way. What was your reaction after the White House says President Obama will visit Ethiopia?
Sure. So, you know, on the one hand, I wasn't very surprised because the African Union headquarters are there and the president has done a really remarkable job of strengthening relations between the United States and the regional organization and the continent more generally. But it was pretty disappointing given the recent election that was held in Ethiopia to know that he'll also be doing bilateral meetings because Ethiopia has made a dramatic turn over the last decade in the wrong direction when it comes to opening up political space, engaging its citizens in political participation, and supporting civil society.
Now, Human Rights Watch has asked Mr. Obama to raise issues of human rights there. But why should he do so, especially when his mission has been built as strengthening ties and highlighting America's long-standing commitment to investing in Africa?
So part of the president's trip is obviously to support economic investment projects like Power Africa and, you know, greater economic development. But there's two reasons why he needs to be bringing up human rights at the same time. The first is because any part of legitimate and long-term economic development in Africa and in Ethiopia specifically will require a government that is able to engage with its citizens, where its citizens are able to speak their minds freely, to express themselves without fear of being imprisoned, and that all populations have access to this economic development. So part of his engagement needs to include that type of language. But the other part is because the United States has said many times, this administration actually has said many times, that the policy towards Ethiopia is three-pronged. There's a security prong, there's a development prong, and there's a human rights and a governance prong. And right now it seems like that third prong, human rights and governance, is just falling flat when it comes to engagement. And so he has an obligation to make sure that he brings up all three points and pushes very hard for some key issues to try to help reverse the current trend in the country.
Well, supporters of the ruling party in Ethiopia say the terrorism laws existing on the books are necessary to combat both domestic and external terrorists. What do you say to that?
The terrorism law that was put on the books in 2009 has very, very broad language, and so it has been able to sweep up and detain a number of individuals that, from our calculation and research, are basically in prison due to their interest in expressing their own minds, to dissenting from the ruling party. And so while we understand that there are legitimate security threats in Ethiopia that need to be addressed and should be addressed, the way to do that is not to muzzle civil society and independent voices. And using the anti-terrorism law for those types of situations is unacceptable.
Well, Ms. Morgan, the supporters are also saying that the Human Rights Watch appears to be singling the country out for criticisms instead of highlighting the good news of economic progress the country has chalked so far or is experiencing now. What's your response to that, briefly?
Well, we try to be as balanced as we can, but we are a human rights organization, and we do look at long-term consequences of violations of human rights and international humanitarian law. And so while we recognize that Ethiopia has moved forward in the economic development arena, we're worried about the long-term consequences of these abuses and how we'll undermine that success.
Thank you very much. Sarah Morgan is the director at Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C. She joined us live via telephone link. The Tanzanian government has come under criticisms after enacting a string of media laws. Journalists accused the administration of flouting the constitution with the new measures they said are aimed at muzzling the press ahead of the upcoming October general election. I reached Asamoah Mbeni, the Tanzanian government spokesman, to explain the administration's stance over the new media laws.
Well, I think it depends on what exactly they are saying, because if you are to look at the key issues that have been raising, for instance, they talk about access to information bill. They have been complaining that the aspect that gives no room to someone who gets information for public use. So they are saying, you know, that clause undermines the freedom of information itself that it is said to protect. But when we prepared this, I was partly well involved, so I know a clause like this one, and we copied, looked at what the U.S. Freedom of Information says, what the U.K. Freedom of Information says, what the India Freedom of Information, our access to information, right to information clause says about the same thing. And you'll be very surprised that maybe our colleagues have no guts to read or look at best practice elsewhere in the world.
As I understand where you're coming from, however, they are saying that they need to be brought to speed, and the mindset of the countries that you're talking about are not necessarily the same mindset back home, and that the Constitution guarantees freedom of information and freedom of speech. Now, placing money on it, it's unconstitutional and undermines the Constitution that guarantees that freedom of information and freedom of speech. What do you say to that?
That's what I'm saying. It depends on how you set up, because there is no country elsewhere in the world that I know of that is able to provide everything for, you know, for free. We have many governments and many services that are being provided that, you know, citizens have to contribute partly. And so the countries that are really practicing this law in place already, they are doing the same. And we don't think that we are doing what really is against the providing the very freedom of information that we are striving to, you know, to the culture we are striving to build in our own country. So there's nothing hidden with the government in terms of providing these freedom of information. We are simply coming up with a legislation which is in intent and in practice, you know, spells out a clear responsibility partly on the government, but also responsibility partly on the citizen themselves. And it's a very, very small aspect of it.
Now, Asa, some media practitioners in the country have said that the government has always not been forthcoming with information with regards to ministers and high government officials usually refuse to pass on information needed by these journalists to educate the public. And by placing monetary value on it, basically you are adding another block of refusing to provide information to the public. And they are saying that the government will use this to criminalize and possibly to jail media practitioners on this particular laws. What do you say to that?
The aspect of payment has nothing to do with the penalty. it's an aspect that, for instance, if we have designed this law to the extent that the public information officers will be duty bound to provide information at a certain time, and you have to provide this information within a certain say period of maybe 1 week or 3 days, and if you fail to provide this information to the public, then the person who is seeking that information can go to court and take to task this information officer to say he failed to provide this information, and he can also be taken to task or being even jailed. So the aspect of payment of money has no relation to the penalties that we are talking about, because it is only spelling out, talking about the citizens' obligations partly to contribute to a certain information that it might be very expensive to get that information that he's seeking for, including, for instance, issues of photocopying and all these.
Asa Mwambene is the spokesman for the Tanzanian government. He spoke with me from the capital, Dodoma. Activists in Nigeria are mounting a campaign to get the country's National Assembly to open its books and explain how it spends its money. The campaign is already getting results. Chris Stein reports from VOA's regional bureau in Dakar.
As the 109 senators and 360 House representatives of Nigeria's 8th National Assembly got down to business this month, they did so under the watchful eye of Olusegun Onagbindi, lead partner of nonprofit Budget. The group is campaigning for greater transparency in how lawmakers spend their $577.5 million yearly budget. Through social media, the courts, and meeting with lawmakers, Onagbindi says he hopes to cut through some of the secrecy.
There is so much speculation to say this is how much National Assembly has. Nobody can give you a factual figure unless something that is speculated. And this question is, let us know the allowances. Let us know how much you spent in managing your office and the rest.
He says the body has spent about $3 billion in the past 4 years, but refuses to say what it's done with the money. So he's suing to find out. Nigeria recently underwent a seismic political shift. In this year's elections, the opposition All Progressives Congress, or APC, triumph over the People's Democratic Party, or PDP, which has controlled the presidency in the National Assembly since 1999. Now the PDP is in opposition, and the APC controls the presidency and both houses. Onagbindi says he hopes to take advantage of the new blood in the National Assembly and across Nigeria's power structure to press for transparency.
It's a movement going day by day that we need a National Assembly that is open and also demand something from all agencies of government.
The campaign is underway on social media. On Twitter, Nigerians use the hashtag OpenNAS to question how the new lawmakers are spending money. Social media entrepreneur Jafet Omajua has been tweeting about the campaign to his 230,000 or so followers. He says he's long pushed for more transparency from the assembly, angered by what he says are lavish salaries in a country where millions live in poverty.
Tell us exactly who's getting what, how much are your aides and assistants getting? How much are you spending on maintenance of your offices? Common sense stuff.
He's hopeful that with a new government in power, he might finally get answers.
A huge chunk of the lawmakers are fresh, so they should be in a position to want to do things differently.
The campaign has already gained traction, at least on Twitter. Senate President Bukola Saraki has tweeted using the OpenNAS hashtag in the opening weeks of the legislature, saying details of lawmaker allowances would be made public. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Meanwhile, Christian clerics in Kaduna, Nigeria, this past week distributed food items to prisoners and less privileged people to mark the start of the Holy Muslim month of Ramadan. Leaders said this is part of an effort to promote peace between the two main religions in the region. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kaduna state is often divided along religious lines. But for the last couple of years, members of Peace, Revival and Reconciliation Foundation have paid a visit to all prisons in the city of Kaduna to distribute food, soaps and buckets to Muslim inmates and pay fines for those serving short sentences. Receiving the donation on behalf of the Kaduna Central Prison, Ismail Sayidu said prison officials will distribute the contribution equally.
I wish to receive this wholeheartedly and I will extend our good fellowship to the inmates. And definitely this, what will they give us, we are going to use it digitally.
Pastor Johanna Buru, the founder of the organization, says they are doing such donations to win the hearts and minds of the Muslim population in the city.
I said, let me bring something for our Muslim to foster peace between us and them, for mutual understanding, so that they may break their fast this evening and pray for our nation. Pray for peace in this country, pray for peace in northern Nigeria, peace in Kaduna State, and peace to the world.
Kaduna is one of the states that experiences religious and ethnic divisions. Pastor Buru says his organization wants to break the boundary that divides the two groups and bring them together. The pastor has also secured the release of four inmates from the prisons.
There's the only remaining people that were four in numbers. The other one are hard criminals, and I said I don't do that for hard criminals because they are danger to society. So the only four that could give me, I said, I'm okay. If it is only one person, we don't want to break the tradition of Peace, Revival and Reconciliation Foundation that every year we're releasing Muslim prisoners for the Ramadan fasting. So we must maintain that.
23-year-old Abubakar Haruna is one of the four prisoners released Thursday with the help of the organization. Haruna has been in the prison for 3 months. He says he was arrested when police could not arrest his friend who stole an earring. He says he's a free and happy man.
He says he's happy the pastor helped him get out of prison,
and that with the first day of Ramadan, it is such an excellent day for him and his life. Thanks to God. Buru said people like Haruna need help regardless of their tribe and religious affiliation. He argues that this type of gestures will foster peace and unity in the country. The pastor knows that some inmates suffering in prisons were not guilty of any offence, but were in jail due to failures in the country's judicial system. He says these are the people the foundation has been helping to get out of prisons in the last 4 years. In 2014, the Peace, Revival and Reconciliation Foundation secured the release of six prisoners, but a group member says they want to get more prisoners out, especially the reformed ones, so that they can help to build a peaceful city, state and a country. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Kaduna.
Cameroonian economy is on its knees as the Central African nation suffers the worst power outages since independence. Huge consignments of goods, some destined for landlocked countries like Central African Republic, Chad and Sudan, have been stockpiled at the Douala seaport for more than 6 weeks now. Cameroon lawmakers are asking for investigations, even though the main energy supplier says poor rains are to blame. VOA Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Cameroon's largest city, Douala.
Cameroonian lawmaker Walang Richard says his country is hurting and that he is pressing for a parliamentary commission to inquire into the epileptic power supply.
If you look at the country today, everybody is crying to have a giant water project that we are putting on. But immediately the light goes off, there is no water. These are things that are really creating problems. Take, for instance, children who are struggling to write exams and they are reading. Suddenly, like that, you see the light goes off. How do you get a candle? By 1 o'clock, by 2 o'clock, by 3 o'clock a.m.
Only 30% of the population is connected to electricity grid due to underdevelopment. More than 70% of Cameroon's current energy supply comes from traditional biomass fuels, and the potential of huge gas reserves remain to be explored. Cameroon has an estimated 12,000 megawatts of hydro energy potential, but only a fraction has been developed. Peter Gogumo, the technical director of the nation's main energy provider, British-owned Energy of Cameroon, ENEO, blames the problem on poor rainfall.
We have a problem of the poor hydrology, no rains. Many people tend to say, oh, there's rain in Douala and so on. But the rains in Douala go directly into the sea, do not pass through the machines to be turbine. The second cause is we program certain works. Preventive maintenance is something you must have to carry out. We must have to do this preventive maintenance. Better suffer now so that in future you'll be able to have better quality of service.
But lawmaker John Evaristus places the blame squarely on Enel management failing to deliver.
The paradox about it all is that at the heart of the rains, we are talking about turbines not turning. It is not true. It's not true. The issue is that of lack of management. The issue is that the equipment is obsolete.
In the meantime, businesses in the nation's economic hub say they are suffering as a consequence. Prince Galiga is one of countless Douala businessmen who have been waiting for weeks at the busy port for his container to clear. Because of the outages, he can't pay and claim his container.
When we have to pay some of the charges, you know, sometimes you go and say there's no power and you have to stop and probably wait for one day or 2 days waiting for the current.
Customs broker Muchi Awa says about 2,500 containers, some destined for Chad, Central African Republic, and other landlocked countries that depend solely on the Douala seaport have piled up in the last 6 weeks.
Just because of power failure, the container pays just for 1 day, 25,000 francs. And so if you exceed, just say go about 45 days, you count how much you're going to pay. You will not want to think of what you experience at home. And it has a heavy toll on the economy of your country.
Emmanuel Vermo, who repairs imported second-hand cars, says he has also been out of business.
It's a regrettable situation. I tell you, we are grounded with our machines, and we don't know when the lights will be available and when it will not be. So this completely kills focus for sure in how many days we can go through a business transaction.
As to when the supply will be restored, Cameroon is in the dark. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Douala.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, as Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza continues his bid for a third term, the African Union, along with leaders of the East African community, have called for the postponement of the July 15th presidential election. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, Straight Talk Africa's Chaka Sali and his guests examine if African leaders should have term limits. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shamari and his guests discussing accents. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joban.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Segun Ademi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Ademi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, June 21st. All the three African representatives, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, and Nigeria, have now been eliminated from the ongoing 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. Cameroon, a debutant at the tournament, lost 1-0 to China on Saturday to become the last of the African teams to be eliminated. Ivory Coast, also making its first appearance at the tournament, and Nigeria, the highest-ranked African team at the competition, did not even advance beyond the first round. For Nigeria, which has featured in all editions of the four-yearly Women's World Cup, this marks the fourth consecutive time that the country's national women's team, the Super Falcons, has failed to advance beyond the first round. Meanwhile, Cameroon coach Ino Ngachu has blamed the lack of funding and preparation for the poor performance of the African teams at the FIFA Women's World Cup. We need to develop women's football in Africa. We need good organization. We also need to create as many clubs as possible. If we could have sponsorship, it would be good, Ngachu says. She says while African nations have talented players, they face the problem of preparation. Cameroon becomes just the second nation from Africa to make it out of the group stages at the Women's World Cup after Nigeria in 1999. Cameroon lost to reigning champion Japan 1-0 in their group matches, but went on to beat Ecuador 6-0 and Switzerland 2-1. Turning to another FIFA tournament, the Under-20 World Cup, Serbia pulled off a historic 2-1 win in extra time to beat heavily favored Brazil in the final in Auckland, New Zealand on Saturday. The scores were locked at 1-1 at the end of regulation play, but Nemanja Maksimovic put away the winner with 2 minutes remaining in extra time. Maksimovic had earlier set up Serbia's opening goal in the 70th minute, but they had little time to celebrate the goal as Brazil struck back almost immediately with a brilliant solo effort by Andreas Pereira. The World Cup win is Serbia's first title as an independent nation. Meanwhile, Africa did not return empty-handed from the tournament. Mali beat Senegal 3-1 to clinch third place on Saturday, with midfielder Adama Traoré scoring two of Mali's goals. Incidentally, it was Senegal that opened scoring in the 64th minute. Senegal defender Moussa Ba was sent off in the final minute of the first half after bagging his second yellow card. In a related development, Traoré was awarded the Golden Ball as player of the tournament at the Under-20 World Cup. Traoré, who is based in France, joins some of football's most famous names in winning the award. Juventus star Paul Pogba won it in 2013, Lionel Messi won in 2005, and Diego Maradona in 1979. Away from the FIFA Under-20 World Cup, Ricardo Manetti quit as coach of Namibia on Thursday, just 19 days after guiding the country to its greatest football achievement. Last month, the brave warriors of Namibia defeated the Mambas of Mozambique 2-0 to win the 2015 COSAFA Cup for Southern Africa. Manetti will be replaced by former Brave Warriors goalkeeper Ronnie Canadello, who has been assistant coach for 2 years. The coach gave no reason for quitting, merely saying it is based on personal reasons. In African athletics, Kenyan runner Mary Keitany smashed the course record as she and her compatriots dominated the Matoni Olomouc Half Marathon in the Czech Republic on Saturday. Keitany clocked 1 hour, 6 minutes and 38 seconds for her 8th sub-67-minute performance for the distance. Rose Chelimo of Kenya finished second in 1 hour, 8 minutes and 33 seconds, while another Kenyan, Angela Tanui, was third in 1 hour, 8 minutes and 41 seconds. In the men's event, Kenyan Josphat Kiptis won in a personal best time of 1 hour and 21 seconds. Two other Kenyans, Jonathan Mayu and Cosmos Birech, finished second and third, respectively. Finally, boxing. Ghanaian boxer Charles Sadamun lost by a unanimous decision to super middleweight Patrick Nielsen of Denmark in a title fight on Saturday in Copenhagen, Denmark. According to the boxing website fightnews.com, the fight was for Nielsen's World Boxing Association international title. All the judges scored the one-sided 12-round fight, 120-108. The 38-year-old Adamu has won 23 fights and lost 7 since turning professional. As an amateur, he represented Ghana in the 1998 Kuala Lumpur Commonwealth Games, winning a bronze medal, and in the 2000 Sydney Olympics, where he reached the second round. As a professional, he's a 2-time holder of the Commonwealth Super Middleweight title. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent.
They make me want to come to go
Our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Yet again, there was a brouhaha involving the International Criminal Court, the African Union, and the government of South Africa. This time it revolves around the failed attempt to get the arrest of President al-Bashir of the Sudan and deliver him to the ICC in The Hague. The stage was set by the convening of the summit meeting of the AU in Johannesburg a week ago. The government of South Africa, the Thursday preceding the weekend summit, decided to give full diplomatic coverage to all the attendees of the conference, along with the staff of the AU. But a South African NGO was not deterred. It approached a court in South Africa with the aim of requesting the court to compel the South African government to arrest President al-Bashir and deliver him to the ICC in The Hague. As you may be aware, the ICC had issued a long-standing arrest warrant for the Sudanese president. Now, the courts and those who are the friends of the ICC stressed that this court was an independent judiciary. Others, however, believe that the court was an activist court that was more interested in pleasing the audience outside of Africa. And the court issued a preliminary decision requesting the government of South Africa to prevent the exit of President al-Bashir from South Africa until it had delivered a decision as to whether or not President Bashir should be arrested. On the face of it, it looks reasonable, but in essence, it was a very poor decision. Anyone who is familiar with diplomatic immunity under international law, something which has been maintained for centuries and is also contained in the Convention of Diplomatic Relations of Vienna, could see the risks that the court took. The court must have known the schedule of the AU summit. Yet, the court said to the government that it must not allow President al-Bashir to move until it had decided on the case. Now, the court could have taken one day to make a decision. It could have taken 1 week to make a decision. It could have taken 1 month to make a decision. The implication is that the South African government would have been compelled to detain President al-Bashir in South Africa until the court had acted. This would be contrary to all the principle of diplomatic immunity. It would mean that the government of South Africa will be violating its own diplomatic immunity given to all the conferees of the summit. This was a dilemma. Then what should the government of South Africa do? Of course, it appealed the case. But there was also the issue of whether or not it should or should not obey the court. And we know what has now happened. The next issue then was whether or not the government of South Africa has an obligation outside of the court's ruling to hand over President al-Bashir to the ICC. In this context, it is surprising that all of the commentators, even so-called experts of international law, have not taken into account something which transpired just after the setting up of the ICC. A number of African countries signed bilateral agreement with the United States, which states that these governments should not turn over to the ICC nationals of the U.S. that may be desired by the ICC. None of these so-called human rights advocates challenged that decision of the bilateral agreement. Are not these African states under the same obligation to obey their agreement under the Rome Statute? Why is it okay for them not to obey it, and why is South Africa compelled to do it? Another issue which was raised was the issue of universal obligation. I could recall that in Belgium, years ago, an NGO went to Belgian courts to seek the arrest of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. There was such a pushback from the United States and some Western countries that the matter was dropped. Similarly, it was done in Spain. A judge in Spain was trying to arrest some Western officials. Again, the pushback was very strong, and the matter was dropped suddenly. But now, efforts are going to Africa to ensure that they do what could not be done in Europe. Now, South Africa, of course, will have to face a different tune depending on whether it complies with the court's request for answer as to why President al-Bashir left the territory of South Africa. But this will not deal with the question of diplomatic immunity. This will deal with national law. And depending on its answer, it may find itself in a very ticklish situation of a court charging government officials of judicial crime in not following the court's decision. But this is something which will depend on other matters. Of course, next for the African Union is to decide whether or not the African Union members should pull out of the ICC, something which many are advocating. But this could not happen because if they decide to pull out, they will be under enormous pressure by powerful economic powers who will threaten sanctions if they do that. one reason why this commentator has never ceased to advocate that Africans should reduce their dependence on outside economic and financial powers. Until they do that, they cannot exercise their sovereign rights. And this is one of the reasons why the AU itself will find it difficult to be completely sovereign. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, if you don't want the tail of a monkey to touch you, then don't attend the monkey dance. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash recently announced a final rule to classify all chimpanzees, both wild and captive, as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, or ESA. The rule upgrades the status of captive chimpanzees from threatened to match that of wild chimpanzees and removes them from a special rule for primates that allowed some activities otherwise prohibited under the ESA. Threats to the chimpanzee, including habitat loss, poaching, and disease, have intensified and expanded since wild populations were listed as endangered in 1990. These threats are exacerbated by an increasing human population, the expansion of settlements, and increasing pressure on natural resources to meet the needs of the growing human population. The ESA does not allow for captive-held animals to be assigned separate legal status from their wild counterparts on the basis of their captive state. Chimpanzees are found in a wide but discontinuous distribution in 22 countries of equatorial Africa. Across the range of the species, high deforestation rates are destroying and fragmenting forests. Widespread poaching, capture for the pet trade, and outbreaks of disease are impeding chimpanzees' ability to sustain viable populations in the wild. The Fish and Wildlife Service has funded $9.4 million in grants for conservation efforts to protect chimpanzees, matched by an additional $11.5 million in leverage funds. These grants have supported field projects in 19 countries. The service will work closely with the biomedical research community to permit biomedical research that must use chimpanzees as research subjects. The final rule will publish in the Federal Register on June 16, 2015, and will go into effect 90 days after publication on September 14, 2015. Extending captive chimpanzees the protections afforded their endangered cousins in the wild will ensure humane treatment and restrict commercial activities under the Endangered Species Act, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Ash. The decision responds to growing threats to the species and aligns the chimpanzee's status with existing legal requirements. Meanwhile, we will continue to work with range states to ensure the continued survival and recovery of chimpanzees in the wild.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.